It's the Currents Music News Podcast, the daily podcast where we tell you what you need to know about what's going on in the music world. I'm Jay Gabler. Today is Thursday, February 14th. Normally, we devote Thursdays to new music, and we are going to do that this week, except we are postponing that discussion until tomorrow. Today, we need to talk about a New York Times article about Ryan Adams that's just been published. It's a major article. People are really talking about it in the music world. It details accusations of emotional abuse and sexual exploitation by the singer-songwriter, with sources including Ryan Adams' ex-wife Mandy Moore and the singer-songwriter Phoebe Bridgers. For today's episode, in light of this article and all the conversations that it spurred, we decided to reach out to Jessica Hopper. She's one of the country's most respected music writers. Most recently, she is the author of the memoir Night Moves. And on Twitter, at Jess Hopp, J-E-S-S-H-O-P-P, she's created an essential hub for conversations around these issues of sexism in the music industry. She took some time to talk with us about all the issues that this article has raised and the continuing conversations that people are having about how to make the music world a safer space for artists and fans. So what were your first thoughts when you read this article about Ryan Adams?
I was not terribly surprised to hear this, just because there is such a long history with him kind of just being a caustic presence and being, you know, abusive towards his audiences, towards so-called friends, being very antagonistic publicly, and then, you know, certainly you hear about things privately from people as well, just given his reputation. But my experience being in music and in reporting these sort of stories in the past, that sometimes people's volatility, if they're willing to abuse an audience in public, they are oftentimes very much doing that same behavior in private.
And so you weren't hugely surprised with respect to the name at the top of this article and some of the details surrounding who it was. And it seems like also the types of interactions that are described in this new New York Times article are, you know, in sync with experiences you have heard about, know about, maybe have experienced from women in the music industry. On Twitter, you've certainly been interacting for years and amplifying the voices of women who have been sharing stories like this.
A lot of that aspect of manipulation that these women speak about in the article is incredibly commonplace, of men leveraging, and it's not always just men, but an abusive power of leveraging access and influence for sexual favors, or, you know, basically this really creepy quid pro quo of, yeah, I'll get you this opportunity, or I'll introduce you to this person, or, you know, I'll pass your demo, or et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, that there is sexual favor required. And if that isn't forthcoming, then those opportunities disappear, then that person's mentorship dries up. It is all but, you know, demanded that you sleep with someone in order for your career, your collaboration, your access through that person to continue. And that is, I mean, that is old as rock and roll. That's a story as old as rock and roll itself. It is a story I've also heard from people, you know, in terms of hip hop, in terms of the world of recording and studios and production. Certainly music journalism, I'm well aware of those stories. And, you know, even as a young person myself, that was standard operating procedure.
Yeah. And I think a lot of what we're hearing people say now is certainly someone like Ryan Adams, or certainly a Bill Cosby or Harvey Weinstein, are very relatively powerful people with a lot of big opportunities to potentially dangle. But this type of pattern, you don't need to be a household name in the music industry to be a gatekeeper, to have this kind of power to wield over someone.
No, absolutely not. I mean, this is a sort of thing that happens with people who even just have a modicum of power, of someone whom, I think I said last night, you know, somebody who the power they're leveraging is getting your band on a good local bill, you know, getting you up from you know, first of four opener on a Tuesday night to like a support headline for a national touring artist who has a big reputation. It is not just marquee name men who are operating in this way. I mean, this is really something that happens at the most lowly opportunities. And you know, I think also you can see last night from conversations online, this also happens with people who are merely seeking bandmates and collaborators who try to, you know, pivot a creative relationship into something else. It's hard to explain how endemic this is to music. And also, as people were saying last night, this is in every industry. Yesterday, I spoke to a friend who is a 25-year veteran of restaurant and bar industry and was like, oh, yeah, I mean, this is just it. I think there's a lot of people saying this is just how it is. But I think we also really have to look in this moment. This is not a new conversation. You know, Jay, I'm 42, and I've been writing about this and talking about this since I was 16 years old and Xeroxing my fanzine at the Kinko's in Uptown Minneapolis. And so this is not a new thing. It is obviously a much more high-profile thing, and I think the things that we really have to look at right now amid this conversation are, how do we move this beyond women just saying, this is happening, over and over, and people going, wow, this is surprising, or people going, this is not surprising, and moving towards really everyone making collective measures for safer spaces, for more transparent and available opportunity for people who are marginalized and vulnerable to participate in music. And so it is less of an old boys network or an old creeps network, as we know. And also to look at whose voices are not coming into this conversation, because there is a much higher price to pay as a young person of color, as a woman of color, as a trans person operating in these spaces, than it is for white women. This is very much a white women's conversation. And lots of times the people who are speaking out are people like me who have some measure of power, and it is harder to take it away from them because we have 20, 25-year careers, 15-year careers. We have something of our own that we've built outside of this, or because we are people who are known for speaking out. But it has to also be people holding their local venues accountable. There's so many people that could just step up and say, enough is enough. We are going to put a safer spaces policy in action. We are going to do training for our sound people, for venue staff that allows for people to feel safer in these spaces and for there to be real accountability for people in scenes, because this isn't just happening at the highest level. And there are really concrete actions that people can take and commit to that can radically shift the possibility of these things coming to pass and make music a safer space for everyone involved. And to commit to accountability is the mere basic minimum of what people can and should be doing.
What are things that venues, anyone in the music industry can do now?
If you are in a band with someone that you see their creepy behavior happening and you see women in particular avoiding people who are in your band, if you know someone in your band has a reputation, if you've seen it, if when they get drunk they turn into an a-hole, if they are hitting on women at the merch table, if they are being creepy to women in bands, people in bands, stop turning a blind eye to it. Make that person have consequences. Confront them. Kick them out of your band. There you go. Quit your band. Really, on a personal level, people can do things like that. Venues can have safer spaces policies. There is so much collective wisdom that you can draw on. There's best practices. You can simply Google them. There are venues that have committed to these sort of practices that other venues can draw upon. But also as patrons of venues, as people who play venues, as people who write about these venues, you can simply tweet and say, hey, First Avenue, Empty Bottle, wherever, what are your safer spaces policy? What are you willing to do to enact this? You can stop playing those places. You can start petitions. But you can hold these places publicly accountable for just enacting these things and creating zero tolerance policies and best practices and training for their staff. That is one thing. And then record labels and other people who are in positions of power can also commit to similar best practices, but also, you know, publicizing those and having measures of transparency, but also simply no longer turning a blind eye to these things. And also, labels can do things to lower, I don't want to say lower the barrier, but just like being like, hey, if you are interested in getting music to this label, here's our website, you know, email address. There's plenty of people that really have like a high barrier because they don't want to be, quote unquote, inundated with bad demos and, you know, harassing emails or like whatever from anxious people making bedroom music or whatever it is, that they want it to be like a curated network. But you know what happens when that's the case? Is that people are having to jump through the hoops or make themselves vulnerable to people who are creeps for access to some of these labels. And sometimes these labels don't know this, but also we know at this point, this is the whole history of, you know, the last 50, 60 years of recorded music.
Yeah.
We can't be stupid about it. Some of these are hard choices. Some of these choices are going to cost people opportunities, money, time. They're going to be agonizing decisions, but we have to make them because we know what happens when we don't.
And your mention of that merch table scenario sort of brings up an aspect of this Ryan Adams story that I think we're seeing more and more. It's always been a pattern, a problem, but takes on new dimensions in the digital era, which is this aspect of sort of fan cultivation, where you start corresponding with fans who might become artists, might not be, but maybe it's text, maybe it's DMs, and things get to a bad place.
Yeah, or in the case of Ryan Adams, it's 3,217 text messages to someone who's 15 years old.
Yeah, and I feel like I'm seeing up-and-coming bands, you know, responsible bands being hyper-aware, as they should be at an early stage in their careers. Here are the boundaries we need to set with fans to be sure mm-hmm. that we are being transparent and having, you know, the right kind of boundaries.
And also for bands, too, to say things like, you know, I don't hug people. I don't do hugs. There's definitely a lot more of a conversation around personal boundary with people and not assuming that hugs or certain kinds of touching are okay, you know, between people. Because one, you know, just because someone is like really friendly, you don't know that it's okay to touch the small of someone's back. Some people really, that can make them deeply uncomfortable, and to really monitor one's physical transactions with people. We see now, I think there was, you know, certainly a lot of public hand-wringing around, oh, creepy in the DMs, what does that mean? Well, we see now, sometimes creepy in the DMs is exactly what we see comes to pass with this Ryan Adams, you know, with this young woman, Ava, of someone really harassing someone and coercing someone who's vulnerable via DM and via text message and making inroads those ways, that in ways that are grossly inappropriate. But also, I think part of these conversations are people saying, you know, I don't feel comfortable having this sort of, like, please don't ask if you can have a hug. I don't do hugs. You know, stuff like that, particularly female artists in the last, you know, couple of years within the DIY scene, I've definitely seen a lot more of that. And I think that's really great that we're having just richer conversations about what's appropriate, because I think so long things have just been written off, as it said in the article, sex, drugs, rock and roll. Oh, he was drunk. Oh, she was drunk. Or, like, you know, this is just how it is. You know, we've had 50 years of this is just how it is. Take it or leave it. This is the price of entry if you want to be a young person who is marginalized within these spaces. This is the price of entry. And that price of entry is far too high.
So, yeah, I mean, as you say, this is pervasive across industries. And takes on a certain dimension in music and art, because you do, as a fan, feel like you form a sort of emotional relationship with an artist just by listening to their music. And when you learn about things like this, it changes the way you think about the artist, changes the way you think about their music. And whenever something like this happens, then people start saying...
I mean, for some people, yes. For a lot of people, I think this is rock and roll, or what did you expect? There's so many people last night, and it was very predictable to see so many people saying, well, what do you expect? He's a a-hole. He's a this. He's a that, you know?
Yeah. What about the conversations around music of the past and the artists of the past? And as you say, this has been going on for 50 years.
That is really a difficult conversation, because it becomes how often in the past within music that women were considered, their bodies, their autonomy, all of these things were considered, you know, just rewards for a show well played, or deserving homage to the greatness of someone. You know, someone makes a great record, so yeah, they're allowed to, you know, have a 14-year-old quote-unquote girlfriend. And it is also hard, because we do have various sort of testimony of women from the past who said, you know, being a groupie was part of my agency. And so there's a lot of different things, because obviously it was a different place and time. There were different cultural norms. But at the same time, we really have to look at the historic, systemic ways that women have been silenced, that survivors have been silenced, that the barriers for entry within music have been so high, and women's experiences have been so toxic, that it has contorted and distorted and corroded, you know, music history. Our source materials are corrupted. The phenomenal racism and sexism and othering of so many people, you know, that we really have to look around, not just at our past, but also very recent history, and try to uncover these histories, and try to really cast a cynical eye on so much of this, you know, these, and see the way that the R. Kellys and the predation of Bryan Adams and other artists is just not, it is just regular. It is regular. How you approach it is on a case-by-case basis, but I think it really, all of us really need to interrogate history and where we get our information, and all of the things that has distorted the information and what has been lost in the mythology of the great man in music.
Thanks to Jessica Hopper for taking time to talk with us about these very important issues. That's it for today's episode of The Current's Music News Podcast. Our producer is Jade. Jade and I will be back tomorrow to talk about this week's new music.